So let's start in chapter 12, and we're just going to read through this. Can I get somebody to read verses 1 through 5? And you might have a comment about this. Now, what I have up on the board is the American Standard Translation. If you would prefer to read it from a different translation, that's okay. If you want to read it from your translation. But I put it on the board so it makes it easier for us to follow along. And let me just have a quick show of hands. Is that print big enough that everybody can? Linda, can you read that? Okay. Anne, you can read it from back there? Okay. I try to make it big enough that everybody can see it. So who wants to read this? Okay, Carol.
About that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to the four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in the prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God.
Okay. What do you see there?
Well, the tide has turned. Now the persecution is starting because everybody wants to please the Jews who have been in power, and they think that this is a way to placate them.
Okay.
And they figure, okay, we already got rid of James, the brother of John. We'll just pick off another one here. There'll be no problem. God's not with them, so keep making a big show of it. Ingratiate myself.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, unfortunately, it's kind of the way things go. You know, when you read about Jesus being put to death and why Herod would have agreed to this and why the Jews were all about that, Herod has a kind of precarious position. The Jews kind of like Herod. The Romans like Herod as long as he keeps the peace. Okay. They don't want anything going on in Judea. They've had problems with Judea. Judea's been kind of a political problem for them ever since the time of the Maccabees, which is 100 BC. And they kept having to send soldiers to put down these rebellions in Judea. So Herod is looking at the political reality and he says, yeah, I need to keep these Jews happy. Because if I don't, they'll rise up, there'll be a rebellion, and then they're going to move me off to the Bronx, you know, or someplace like that. And he's got a pretty cushy job there in Judea. Aside from the fact that he has to deal with these rebellious Jews, he's got a pretty cushy job. And the Jews kind of understood the stranglehold that they had on Herod. Herod would listen to them because they kept saying, oh, if you don't listen to us, we'll rebel. And so Herod keeps listening to them. Do you see that as a parallel to what's happening in our country today? You know, you get all of these woke corporations that pander to the woke crowd, who is saying, if you don't do this, we won't support you. And sometimes I look at that and say, why on earth do you care? This woke bunch is such a small part of the whole population. why do you care? And what's happening is a lot of these woke corporations are finding out, hey, we have superhero cartoon characters that have a homosexual kiss, and the woke crowd is going, yeah, great. And everybody else is saying, I don't think I want to go to Disney movies anymore. And all of a sudden, Disney is kind of reconsidering some of this. And they're thinking, we got to pay attention to what's really going on. Well, Herod is doing that. He's just pandering to the Jews. So he takes James, executes him. And the Jews are going, yeah. And Herod is saying, great, my rebellious bunch, you know, they're keeping quiet. I can throw them a bone every once in a while. I don't think Herod was all that excited about stopping Christianity. It wasn't Christianity, it was the idea that there would be a rebellion by anybody. He just wanted to put it down. Now, the interesting thing is, James has never done anything worthy of being executed. It's just like the Apostle Paul said later, when Paul was arrested, he said, if I've done anything worthy of execution, then I refuse not to die. It was trumped up charges. And those trumped up charges are just, it's impossible to deal with. You know, you get to make a defense, but what are you defending yourself against? And I sometimes feel like that's the position that we're in too. So, he's executed James. It pleased the Jews, right? Hey, we got one of them. So he arrests Peter. What on earth has Peter done? Probably nothing. He just gets arrested just because the Jews don't like him. And so it's the Passover. He can't kill him during the Passover. That would not go well with the Jews. Okay. So instead, he puts him in jail. Now, puts him in prison. And apparently, if I can kind of understand the picture here, it's like Peter is chained to two guards. So he's guarded by four squads of guards. Why would he do that? Why would he have four squads of guards?
Well, they had four watches during the night, so probably two of each watch.
Okay.
It's going to be consistently guarded.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But if you're arresting him because you think he is going to provoke a rebellion, then there might be some body who thinks there's an opportunity to break him out. So you want to make sure your security, you've got him secure.
Right. Like the Jews did with Jesus' tomb. We want to make sure that the Christians don't come and steal him away by night. So set a guard on the tomb. So he's got the guards. Not uncommon for them to have four squads. Okay. And he's 24/7. He's chained to two guards. One on each side. Yeah, Bob, you had a comment.
Going to say it was show of strength, but also.
Yeah.
Want to keep the upper hand.
Yeah, it's a kind of Peter has never indicated that he was some kind of dangerous felon who is going to cause the downfall of the Roman Empire. It's a show of strength. It's over the top strength. Okay. So after Passover, he's probably going to kill him. Doesn't say that, but he's probably going to kill him. And then there's this reference that's not surprising. Prayer was made to God intensely by the church. Now, this is in Jerusalem, right? How many Christians are there now in Jerusalem?
Several thousand.
Okay. As many as 5,000.
Possibly, unless,
some of them have left. Some have left just to go back home. Some left because of the persecution. No, it's not that long. Yeah. You mean after Cornelius?
No, after
Pentecost. Yeah, it's about 10 years after Pentecost. Okay.
So between Acts 2 and this, probably about 10.
Yeah, Carol.
I think it's an interesting contrast between the fact that we have to arrest them and put them in prison because they may put together a rescue mission to break him out, and yet it's made obvious that prayer is what breaks him out. And God is going to do it. They are not going to do it. It's just the opposite of rebellion.
Yeah. And I find it interesting that he says prayer was made to God intensely by the church. Now, who was praying? A group of Christians at somebody's house. Okay. Do you think that was the whole church? Probably not. And I find it interesting that he uses the term church to refer to a group smaller than the entirety of the church in Jerusalem. And I guess the reason that I find that interesting is we've talked about the church as having two distinct kinds of meaning. One would be a local group, and the other would be the church in a universal sense, all Christians everywhere who have lived or died. So you've got the church in a universal sense. You've got the church in Jerusalem, for example. I think this is a different way of using that term. It's a group of Christians that were in Jerusalem. It's a little smaller than the church when we think of the local church, but he still calls it a church. Yeah.
Perhaps more of them were praying in his house.
Oh, that could be.
It's like we had a group of people over yesterday for our breakfast thing, and I wouldn't say that was the church. Everybody from church was invited, but we had a group that came over, and we had a task that we did, and I think it would be appropriate to say that the church gathered.
Okay.
For that.
Okay. Yeah, Carol.
Like our one call, when there's a need to pray for somebody, the information goes out to individual groups. So although the church might not come together to pray, I mean, if you were close, if I was close enough, I'd run over and tell Di, and Di might tell somebody else. And so the church, over a time period, would be praying for him. And if they had gotten together, then
okay,
when they went separate, they would be praying for him.
Okay.
Two or more gathered together, there he is with them.
Okay. Okay. Right. I just think I see an indication that you have the church used to refer to the whole church in Jerusalem, and the church is sometimes used to refer to a group of people within that larger body. Yeah, Carol.
Is that why we're supposed to be a holy vessel for God, because we represent the church, even as an individual, and somebody could get turned off by the church just by looking at me as an individual, because I'm a representative?
That's a possibility. That's a possibility. But I wouldn't refer, if you were at Costco, I wouldn't refer to you as the church being at Costco. But yes, you are a reflection of Christianity everywhere you go.
But if somebody heard me talking and then run around and they say, well, you know, she goes to a cult.
Yeah.
That church is a cult. And so it, even though I'm not the church, because they're not two of me, two or more together, the world looks at it that way.
Okay, but even if there were two, you know, if Kim and I go to Costco, there, I don't think anybody would say that that was the church that went to Costco. Okay. Now we are, you're right, we are a representation of what God intended for Christians to be. And like it or not, every interaction that we have is a reflection on God and a reflection on this group of people and a reflection on us personally. Okay. But I think there's a sense in which you can use the term church that's not local, not universal. It's a part of the local body. Okay? Now, if I was talking about it in that sense, what would I do? What could I do? Got to do what they're doing. I could pray, right? So we might have a group. Yeah.
Look at verse 12. It says, when this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and was praying.
Right.
So it's a smaller group. I mean, I think that there were a lot of people praying, but he didn't necessarily go to everybody. He went to a group. And they were there praying. He went to Mary's house.
Right.
And there was a group of people praying.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not saying, I don't know that is the church, that the people that were gathered at Mary's house, it says a large crowd gathered.
Okay.
I'm kind of thinking back when there were some issues in Afghanistan and all of that, and the withdrawal and all of that, and there was a lot of, because I had a lot of concerns. My heart was very heavy, and I invited a bunch of ladies from church to come over and pray together. And we gathered at our house, and I can't remember how many people, I'm going to say 9 to 10 people gathered, and we prayed earnestly for the women of Afghanistan and the marginalized. Because it was a very volatile time. That wasn't the church that came together. It was a group of people from the church. And I think that that's what this is. There are many people gathered. They were probably like, you know what? Let's get together. This is really bothersome. Let's get together and let's pray for Peter.
Okay.
The importance and the value of prayer. That doesn't mean that other people weren't praying.
Okay. Okay. I guess what I'm saying is you can have a group smaller than the church.
It's not necessarily called the church.
I'm saying it would be appropriate to call it the church. In that sense.
I don't see that.
Okay. Okay. Now, what could the whole church do that a part of the church could not do? Can you think of any time when the whole church was told together? What about discipline?
We are the church. Wherever we meet together, wherever there is a group, it is the church, because the whole world has buildings with people in them, but they are the church no matter where they are. So every Lord's Day, every body is supposed to be at a congregation somewhere, and we're all the church. The whole world has church, quote, because it's the individuals that make up the church.
Okay. Okay, so in a universal sense, you're right. In a local sense, the whole local church does some things that a group that's part of the church can't do. Okay? The folks on this side, this is a group of the church, but the group can't come together and withdraw themselves from a brother that's walking disorderly. That's the function of the whole church. Yeah, Carol.
I get your point there, but even when the whole church comes together, it's the leaders and the information and so forth and so on. There's still people who didn't get a chance to come together.
That's true.
That are members of the church. So when you say the whole church came together, that's the majority or the leaders or whatever, and if somebody's out of town.
I don't think that if somebody's out of town and they're missing, I don't think that diminishes the whole church. But I don't think the whole church does something when the elders decide to do it. Okay? And when they appointed the deacons to handle the distribution of food to the Grecian widows, the church came together and did that. Look, the leadership went to the church and said, look you out from among yourselves. They didn't say, we'll pick. They said, the church, look you out from among your... Now, I know that that's not the way that it has evolved in 20th century American Christianity. Okay? But I'm just saying, I think we've kind of missed part of this. Okay? I don't think the elders decide that we're going to withdraw ourselves from a brother that's walking disorderly. They may take the lead, okay? But that's an activity of the church. So I just think it's important that as we think about these things, we stay clear as to what the practice was among the early Christians. Okay. And I understand why we do it the way we do it, but that may not be the way they did it. Now, when the Apostle Paul came to Jerusalem and he wanted to give a report about what had happened on his missionary journey, he called the whole church together. Okay? It was the whole church. He didn't just go to a group that was meeting at Mary's house. He went whole church. And then there are some things that happen in a group that's meeting together. They prayed. They study. Okay. They maybe they sing songs. I don't know. So I think that's important. Verses 6-9. Can I get somebody to read that? I thought we'd have no problem getting through this at all. So we may not get all the way through this. Verses 6-9.
And he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know what was being done by the angels with him, but thought he was seeing a vision. And when they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opens for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from them.
Okay. I think you skipped a little bit ahead, but that's okay. Six through nine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. No problem. You want to read 6 through 9?
Okay. And on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was speaking. Two soldiers bound with two chains and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. Behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and roused him, saying, "Get up quickly," and his chains fell off his hands. The angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals," and he did so. And when he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," and he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision.
What do you see as important there?
That he was able to freely go and everything opened up for him.
Right. The chains fell off.
Sounds exciting.
I'm sorry?
Sounds exciting to me.
Sounds exciting?
Hard to believe it, so he thinks it's a vision.
Yeah. Would you have responded like Peter did? I mean, he pokes him in the side. And he says, "Get up, get dressed." And he pokes him in the side. His chains fell off. And he says, "Get up, get dressed." Would you have looked at that and said, "Maybe this is just a dream. I think I'll stay here." I have a soft spot for Peter. He views this with a certain amount of skepticism. Maybe this is just a dream and I'm still chained to these two guards. But remember, Peter's had this encounter with the sheep that was let down from heaven. Would I be skeptical of that and say, "You know, I don't know what this is"? I wouldn't immediately jump to, "This is God telling me to do something." So I think Peter shows us a certain amount of healthy skepticism.
Well, I think if somebody poked me in the side and I saw a bright light or an angel, I don't know what an angel truly looks like, but I would think that was the authority and you better get up and do it now. And if it's a dream, so be it, but I still got to get up because I want to finish the dream.
Well, you would say if it's a dream, I want to be a part of this, huh?
Yeah, I want to do whatever I'm supposed to so it'll come out in the end like it's supposed to. I don't want to not obey something that I think maybe God said or I did. I just wouldn't question it. I would just finish the dream, quote, if it was a dream.
Have you ever had a dream that told you to do something? And
yes.
And I did it because it
had authority in the voice or whatever, because somebody said, "Well, go to Kelly's house and do such and such." And in the dream, I go because I was called. I was needed to go to Kelly's house.
Okay.
And then when I woke up, which I didn't, I was at Kelly's house for reals when I knocked on the door. I have a good imagination, as you can see. But I think really Peter reacted.
I think... Whenever somebody tells you, "I had a dream and God told me to do this," I don't know. I sometimes look at that and say, "Well, I doesn't seem to fit with everything else that I know about God." Yeah, Kim.
Peter doing this and getting up, I mean, you have to look at it this way. It was in the middle of the
lights, you know, so someone can put the switch on and the light shines. So now there's a bright light shining. And there's an angel, there's a person there, whether the angel looked like it was glowing or whether it looked like a human being. I don't know. But he's putting two and two together. But that's so typical of Peter's personality and his character. What I love about Peter so much is he doesn't ask too many questions. He takes charge. He just goes. He just gets in there and goes. And I think that this is the kind of thing, this is very consistent with who he is. He's like, okay, God's telling me, but then later he looks at him and goes, wow, what's happening here? What's going on? Is this a dream? Is this a vision? And then, you know, as we read on, he figures it out. It dawns on him what has just happened. And he's like, well, now where am I going to go? He goes to Mary's house.
Okay. Okay. I guess I see in Peter what I hope I could be. Pay attention to the dream, but check it out. Or pay attention to what's happening, but check it out. Okay. You're wrong. I'm just teasing you. Angel of the Lord stands by. What does an angel look like? I don't know. How did he know it was an angel? Don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But chains fell off. Okay. Now, maybe that was, Peter would explain that by saying this was a dream. But it's beginning to get more real. This is not like what happens in dreams. They say if you ever fall off a cliff in your dream and you hit the ground, that you would die. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've had a lot of dreams where I fell off cliffs. And I always woke up before I got to the bottom. Okay. This is getting pretty real. This is the cold steel bands that were around his wrists and his ankles. That starts to fall off. Okay. So he does. And then he, as these things start to pile up, it becomes more and more real. Okay, I'll read. Yeah, go ahead, Eileen. That's true. It was not as uncommon for them to have seen a miracle as it would be for us. Okay, so they were perhaps more able to accept that this was a miracle. Okay. Now, when they passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out along one street. Immediately, the angel departed from him. Peter came to himself. He said, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod, from all the Jewish people were expecting. When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and they were praying. Okay. Immediately the angel departs. He finally decides this is real. And he went to the house of Mary, where many were gathered together and they were praying. Now, this, again, I guess is not surprising. Somebody want to read this, 13 through 16?
Peter knocked at the outer entrance, and a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer the door. When she recognized Peter's voice, she was so overjoyed she ran back without opening it and exclaimed, "Peter's at the door." "You're out of your mind," they told her. When she kept insisting that it was so, they said, "It must be his angel." But Peter kept on knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished.
Okay. So these people have a healthy skepticism too. Okay. Whoever it was that was inside praying, can you imagine Peter? He knocks on the door. Rhoda says, "Who's there?" He says, "It's Peter." And she doesn't open the door. She goes to tell everybody else. And it's like, what am I, chopped liver? Okay. So it because of her joy, she did not open the gate. And I don't know whether that was a wrought iron gate that you could see through, or it was some kind of a solid gate. She just heard his voice and didn't see him. I don't know the answer to that. In my mind's eye, this was a wrought iron gate that was across the outer courtyard. Okay. So she sees Peter, hears his voice, and then turns on her heel to run and tell everybody else that Peter's at the gate. And there's Peter standing there. They said, "You're out of your mind." Why did they say that?
Couldn't believe it, because he was there, and it would have been a miracle, which they didn't recognize. But like Kim said, it was dark too. So, but yeah, she just was so excited, and they couldn't believe it either, really, because they said, "Jail, he can't be at the door."
Okay. Remember what happened when the women went after they'd gone to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus for burial on the first day of the week on Sunday morning, and he was not there, and they ran and told the apostles. What was the apostles' response? We got to see this for ourselves. Okay. They didn't immediately say, "Glory be to God, he's raised." It's like when these miracles happen, they are so fabulous, so fantastic. You know that people who are chained to two guards don't just get up and walk off. So they have some skepticism too. Now, it was real, and they eventually saw that it was real. Their first response was, "No, it's not really Peter, it's his angel." It's like that's an easier explanation than to say that Peter has been suddenly released from his chains and is standing outside the door. Just Peter's spirit. Yeah.
Well, but it's the evidence that convinces a person. Until that point, until they see the evidence, when the blind man had mud put on his eyes, he didn't say, I could see, until he went and washed the mud off. So you have to wait for the evidence to be there. And until that point, you sort of fill in, it's a dream, it's his angel, it can't be what they're trying to say. But, you know, and if it was him, why didn't you let him in?
Yeah. Eileen. I don't know. Don't know, Kim.
I was going to say, you know, sometimes when we pray, I don't want to read too much into it, but sometimes when we pray and we have expectations that God will answer the prayer, I think God answered their prayer, but he didn't answer it in the way that they had expected. They probably expected that Herod's going to march him out in front of everybody and either execute him or humiliate him in public or something that, you know, and if he was to be released, it probably wouldn't be this way. And so immediately, so sometimes I think that we misanswered prayer because it didn't get answered the way that we thought it should be answered or would be answered.
Could be. And it could be that their expectation that was that Herod was going to take him out in the public square, humiliate him, torture him perhaps, and then kill him. And they were praying, God, keep Peter strong. Don't let him cry out. You know, I don't know what they were praying. I think they were praying for his release. They may not have. And I think your point is well taken. Sometimes God does things and we miss the answer. Okay. So let's keep an open mind. They were amazed when they eventually opened the door. Motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, report these things to James and the brothers. Then he left and went to another place. So it wasn't the whole group in Jerusalem that was gathered there together. He said, go tell James and the brothers. Okay. So the next thing that we'll encounter, there's no small disturbance when the soldiers, among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. And you can understand why they were a little disturbed by the fact that they lost their prisoner, because when Herod searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. This was not a good thing for a Roman soldier to lose his prisoner. So we know this was real. This was very real. And he took them out and executed them. So, you know, what happens when the Jews convince the Roman soldiers to say, oh, we fell asleep, and they came and snatched the body away? No. If you were set to guard something and you lost it, you died. This provides, I think, striking evidence of the reality of the resurrection. Just because of the way these Roman soldiers behave. Okay? Let's see. Let's get to this very quickly. Then Herod is going to die. And we'll take that up next week.